Good day. Today is Saturday, 28th March 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel if, once you watch this programme, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Well, today, as I said, is the 28th of March, and we are now 1 month, officially 1 month, from the start of the military operation undertaken by Israel and Iran, Israel and the United States against Iran, which began on the 28th of February. And we do so in an atmosphere of growing crisis. Crisis for the global economy as energy prices continue to rise. Crisis in terms of what the United States and Israel are trying to achieve, with Iran remaining defiant, with the Strait of Hormuz closed, with doubts and divisions growing amongst US allies, and with political pressures increasing, I suspect, within the United States itself. Now, the fact that we are in a mood of crisis is suggested by the fact that it appears that over the course of last week, the week that has just passed, there have been two telephone conversations between senior officials, senior American officials, and their foreign counterparts. Both of these conversations are reported to have been tense. One is a conversation reported on by Axios between the US Vice President J.D. Vance and the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu. According to Axios's account, Vance heavily criticized Netanyahu over the course of this call for Netanyahu's systematic overselling of the narrative that in the event of an American-Israeli attack on Iran, there would be a political crisis in Iran and a rapid collapse of the regime there. Well, as we see, 28 days, a month rather, after the start of the war, that has not happened, and there are no signs, as even the Israeli intelligence agencies themselves admit, that it is going to happen. So that was one tense call. We don't know what the outcome of it was. We don't know whether Netanyahu tried to push back against this criticism or whether there was any agreement at all on the way forward. We are not even properly told about why the telephone call took place at all. My guess, for what it's worth, is that Vance has indeed been asked by the president, Donald Trump, to try to find some negotiated exit to this conflict, even though, as I will discuss in a moment, the various claims, the many reports that there are actually meetings between Vance and the Iranians being prepared, for the moment, those claims appear to have no truth behind them. But Vance, who appears to have been frozen out of the president's inner circle in the first weeks of the war, given his well-known scepticism about it, well, the president now seems to have understood that he needs him after all, and he's called him back in, and he's asking Vance to try to find a way out. And I suspect that Vance, in order to try to develop some kind of diplomatic strategy, called the person who he perhaps worries might be the person who will try to obstruct that diplomatic way forward, who is Prime Minister Netanyahu, and this is what perhaps led to the call. Well, that was one call, one tense call that took place over the course of last week. There has been another one, and here we have an account of the call from one of the participants who turns out to be none other than the German Chancellor Friedrich Merz, friend and ally of the United States of very long standing. He has been described as the most pro-American German Chancellor since Adenauer in the 1960s. Anyway, Merz telephoned Trump on Friday. The call apparently did not go well, and after the call, Merz is reported to have said this: "I have great doubt about whether there is a strategy and whether the strategy can be executed." And Merz thus goes on to say that there are growing unease amongst the allies, amongst the US's allies. The call lasted half an hour, and Merz, according to Merz, he told Trump bluntly that if he expects allied backing, then please ask beforehand instead of going straight to the media. And Merz went on to say that the conversation was not without controversy, and that over the course of it, Trump repeatedly brushed off alliance coordination, telling Merz, "I don't need NATO." In other words, to me, frankly, that all looks like a rather heated row. So, difficult calls, a clear sign that things are not going well. And we have further proof that they're not going well today. We've had comments from the US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio. These apparently were intended to reassure US allies. Rubio said that the war would go on for no more than a few more weeks, two or three, certainly not months, obviously not years. That's what Rubio said. Apparently unaware or oblivious to the fact that he's actually adding more weeks to the time frame that his chief, his boss, the President of the United States, had previously indicated, which must further confirm among American allies that the United States has no clear plan and no clear idea of how this war is going. And well, there are reports today in Reuters that prior to the president's climb down last Monday, his reversal of his 48-hour ultimatum to Iran, "Either reopen the Strait of Hormuz or I will destroy your entire energy system." Anyway, over the weekend, that same weekend where the president falsely claimed negotiations were taking place between the United States and Iran, there were indeed diplomatic contacts, but not between the United States and Iran, but between the United States and the Arab Gulf states, over the course of which the Arab Gulf states begged and pleaded with him to call off his ultimatum because they warned of the very thing that I was discussing myself at that very time, whilst the ultimatum was in effect, that an attack on Iran's energy system of the kind that the president had in mind would not cause the collapse of Iran or even the collapse of Iran's energy system. All it would achieve would be a massive retaliation by Iran against the energy systems, energy production facilities, and potentially desalination plants of the Arab Gulf states, which would precipitate a crisis of unimaginable dimensions, and that it was this urging from the Gulf states, and I expect the president's own advisers, which eventually caused him to call his ultimatum off. Well, we have all of this dissonance, we have all of this recrimination and quarrelling and indecision about what to do and disagreements about what to do. For example, just a few days ago, we were all led to believe that there was going to be an attack, an imminent attack on one of the islands along the Iranian coastline, perhaps Kharg Island, perhaps one of the islands in the Strait of Hormuz. The word at the moment, not that you can trust it, is that that particular operation has been called off, at least for the time being. Again, the military people apparently are advising that this is an extremely bad idea and that it should not be pressed forward for all of the many reasons that I and many others have discussed, which is that landing troops on islands simply exposes them to massive attack and retaliation by the Iranians, and that there would be many casualties amongst some of the US's most elite troops for no strategic gain. Well, for the moment, that idea appears to have been called off. There are reports that the president is thinking of deploying a further 10,000 men to the Gulf, perhaps in order to revive this idea in future. I am not sure, by the way, whether this deployment, this alleged deployment, is simply a recycling of reports of the deployments that have already been taking place, the movement of the two US Marine battalions, the movement of the 82nd Airborne Division, the reports that we already know about. But even as we see all this confusion and all of this chaos, the Iranians and their allies continue to make their own moves. And the Iranians continue to launch missile and drone strikes against Israel, the other Middle East countries, American bases, all that kind of thing. But perhaps most ominous of all, this morning, another major actor, a big league player in Middle East terms, the Houthis in Yemen, have joined the war. The intention of the Houthis to join the war was telegraphed a few hours in advance in a report that appeared in Responsible Statecraft, the website of the Quincy Institute. A vital place to go, by the way, in order to get an overall sense of the international situation or of the state of international diplomacy. Anyway, people from Responsible Statecraft had a conversation with some official of the Houthis. This person informed Responsible Statecraft that since the clashes with the United States back in March, the Houthis have rebuilt their missile and drone arsenals back to their pre-March 2025 levels. They have also improved the quality of their missiles and drones, and that they are now ready to enter the war. And they have done it straight after that article appeared. They did it with missile strikes, ballistic missile strikes, on what they say are military targets inside Israel. Now, there's a number of things I want to say. The first is that the Houthis are saying that their ballistic missiles and their drones have been increased in technological sophistication and capability since the March 2025 war. This is exactly the same information that I have received about Iranian missiles and drones, that their capability also has been significantly improved over the last few months. And of course, I was told this some weeks ago, before the conflict began, by a source with information from Russia. And, well, it does look as if the Iranians are indeed receiving assistance from Russia. There are more and more reports about this in the Western media. There are relatively few denials, either from the Iranians or from the Russians. There's no categorical statement from either country saying that this is not happening. And, well, there are, as I've discussed, telltale signs. I think there are more than telltale signs. There are clear signs, in fact, that there has been a significant improvement in Iranian drone capabilities, that the Iranian drones are operating further, that they're operating faster, that they're operating closer to the ground, thereby able to evade missiles, that the Iranian drone operators appear to be far more sophisticated, that the drones can be guided onto targets by controllers operating the drones from inside Iran. In other words, they're no longer just fire and forget weapons as they used to be and as they still were during the drone and missile exchanges that took place between Iran and Israel in 2024 and between Iran, Israel and the United States in 2025. And, well, all of this, as I've said in many programs, is fully consistent with technological assistance being provided by the Russians, who, of course, have themselves perfected all of these technologies over the course of the Ukraine war, where they use them actively. And, well, we also have what appear to be fairly convincing, very plausible reports that the Russians have also been regularly providing Iran with intelligence assistance. The Iranian government, incidentally, about a day ago, published a statement publicly thanking Russia for its support and assistance. Of course, it didn't specify the kind of assistance that Russia is providing, but I can't help but feel that this must have been done to acknowledge to the extent that the Russians and the Iranians feel comfortable about doing, that the Russians are indeed providing Iran with significant assistance, which has improved Iranian capabilities in this conflict. And it appears that the same has happened with the Houthis. Someone, maybe the Russians directly, maybe the Iranians, taking technologies that they might have received from the Russians, maybe the Iranians and the Russians together, appear, according to the Houthis, to have upgraded in some way the Houthi arsenals, to have provided who knows what sort of technologies that might have made precision strikes by Houthi missiles more effective than they might previously have been. Now, just to repeat again a point I made about a week ago, back in 2024, when the idea of the Western powers, Britain, France, and the United States, giving missiles to Ukraine in order to conduct missile strikes against Russia were first floated. President Putin and the Russians warned that there would be consequences if what was for them a red line was crossed in that way. I remember discussing at length at the time that I thought it highly likely that the Russians would respond if there were missile strikes on their territory by providing technological and other assistance to adversaries of the United States and of the Western powers around the world, making it easier for them to strike at American or other Western positions. I said that the Russians were more likely to do that than to conduct strikes themselves because it would give them plausible deniability and would avoid the risk of an uncontrolled escalation spiral. And well, I want to make the point again. Isn't that exactly what it appears that we are seeing? I still get people who tell me about the Russians' weak response to the attacks that have been made upon them. Well, to me at least, based on what I can see and what I know, the situation in the Middle East at the moment appears to point in a completely different direction. And since I'm talking about the Russians, well, this is a good moment to mention further comments that have been made by a senior Russian official, our old friend Dmitry Medvedev, the vice chair of Russia's Security Council, former Russian president, former prime minister of Russia. Anyway, he has discussed the current conflict in the Middle East, and he's talked about it in scathing terms. The likelihood of a nuclear conflict in the Middle East, unfortunately, has increased as a result of this unprovoked, extremely dangerous war that the United States has started. And then he goes on to say, probably the biggest war in the Middle East could still be ahead. And then the Middle East will turn into a long-term hotbed of instability, which could continue there for centuries. Well, Medvedev is given the dramatical language. I agree that we are looking at potentially a very long period of further instability in the Middle East. But centuries? Anyway, let's let that pass. And then Medvedev continues that those holding money or engaged in oil supply in the Middle East need to think very hard about what to do next. And he clearly is referring here to the Arab Gulf states. He says about the Gulf from a prosperous region as a result of the behavior of the United States towards it, together with Israel, which behaved like a bull in a china shop, something irreparable could happen. I think this is the price of a gross mistake, a strategic mistake of the White House. And then he went on to warn about potentially catastrophic consequences. He said the consequences could be fatal for all participants because getting involved in a ground operation at a great distance from the United States threatens the United States with approximately the same consequences as happened in Vietnam, when Washington got involved in a foreign country located 1,000 miles away and for 10 years could not find a decent way out. The United States now faces a very difficult situation, especially since Iran has repeatedly said that in the case of a ground operation, its hands will be untied. And I should add that along with these, I think, entirely relevant parallels with Vietnam, and it is interesting to me that a Russian official is now drawing these parallels, which of course are parallels which I myself have made. I think the United States is closer to stumbling into a Vietnam situation this time than it has been in any conflict in which it has been involved since the 1960s. Just saying. But anyway, along with all of that, Medvedev again warned about the possibility of nuclear weapons proliferation. He said that the Arab Gulf states, losing faith, losing confidence, as they might do, in the security guarantee that the United States has provided them. I discussed all of this in my program yesterday, how America's security guarantee to the Arab Gulf states has proved worthless. Far from protecting them, it has made them targets in an Iran-US war, which has some elements, is beginning to get some of the elements, or so it seems to me, of a US BRICS proxy war, all to be discussed shortly. And Medvedev is saying that in light of that collapse of confidence in the United States and its security, its protection, its promises of protection, there is now a real possibility that the Arab Gulf states, once the conflict is over, will decide that the only route forward for them in order to protect themselves is to follow the nuclear weapons route and to develop nuclear weapons capabilities themselves, independently of whether Iran does so. And I have to say, I do feel that that risk is very real. In fact, I would say that it is a probability. I read about a day ago in the British media an article which claimed, it must be said without attribution and without citation, that within the Iranian leadership, the debate about whether to go nuclear has now restarted with a vengeance, with those who are arguing that Iran should indeed take that route now massively empowered, even though everybody within the political system in Iran understands that this is not something that can be done in a day or an afternoon, that it will require time, and that this is something that Iran can only work towards once the conflict in the Persian Gulf has ended. Anyway, it seems to me that the probabilities now, that the possibility that we're going to see proliferation of nuclear weapons in Iran, amongst the Arab Persian Gulf producers, has hugely grown as a result of this war. I think that we have now gone from what was before just a possibility, maybe an unlikely possibility, into a very high certainty. And I'm going to say something further. I don't think once the fighting has ended, this process is going to take very long. Saudi Arabia is known to have a very strong security relationship with Pakistan, which is a nuclear power. It has been widely rumoured and reported that Saudi Arabia financed Pakistan's nuclear weapons programme, and that part of the deal was that if Saudi Arabia decided that it needed nuclear weapons, that Pakistan would supply them. And, well, I read about 2 weeks ago that article in Eve Smith's publication, Naked Capitalism, about the very close relationship that now exists, well, which has always existed, between Iran and North Korea, which quite plausibly could result in North Korea also an advanced nuclear power, providing nuclear weapons technology and assistance, and for all I know, even nuclear weapons directly to Iran. So it could be, it might be, that even if the war ends tomorrow, next year, we could find ourselves in a nuclear-armed Middle East. I'm not predicting that outcome. I'm not saying definitely that it is going to happen, but it is a possibility which I think policymakers in Washington and in all other global capitals, including European capitals, ought to be taking extremely seriously. They ought to be taking it extremely seriously in Israel as well. The entire argument, foundation argument for this whole conflict within Israel was to prevent Iran acquiring a nuclear weapons capability, which supposedly would pose an existential threat to Israel. This despite the fact that the US intelligence community repeatedly said that Iran did not appear to be, was not in fact, developing a nuclear weapons capability, that Iran had published a religious fatwa from the supreme leader himself, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, prohibiting Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapons capability. But notwithstanding that, we were endlessly told by the Israeli government, and of course this has now been repeated continuously by the President of the United States, Donald Trump himself, that everything must be done to stop Iran acquiring a nuclear weapons capability. Well, we see, on the contrary, that the political balance inside Iran appears to have shifted further towards those who advocate it, to the point where it is now far more likely to happen. And we also see Medvedev warning, and I think warning correctly, that there is now a real possibility of nuclear weapons spreading across the rest of the Muslim Middle East, resulting in a situation where Israel loses its regional nuclear monopoly. How this benefits Israel, how this works to Israel's long-term security or advantage, I am entirely unable to see. Israeli officials have recently been speaking about potential conflict with Turkey. Of course, if Iran and Saudi Arabia develop, acquire nuclear weapons, Turkey is inevitably going to follow, or so at least it seems to me. Turkey certainly has the ability to do it. certainly has the technological skills and the economic resources to do it. It will not want to be left behind. And of course, this anti-Turkey rhetoric we see coming out of Israel at the moment, well, that can only encourage them also to go and follow that course. Well, anyway, I don't want to discuss and explore all this further. I think I've said all I need to say. Discussion of these topics makes me very uncomfortable. But we can see Dmitry Medvedev, vice chairman of the Russian Security Council, now talking about them. And, well, one can understand why, if J.D. Vance has indeed been given some kind of assignment by the president to try to find some way to end this conflict as soon as possible, why he might be trying to get Prime Minister Netanyahu, who has played a central role in bringing about this looming catastrophe, why he's been trying to get Netanyahu to stop, why they might have had tense calls. I can also imagine that if Vice President Vance is indeed trying to act on some kind of instruction to get negotiations with the Iranians going, he's trying to get the Israelis to stop carrying out strikes against sensitive Iranian facilities. But we see that despite these calls between Vance and Netanyahu, assuming that such a request was even made, and of course I'm not even party to these calls, to this call, I don't know exactly what the two said to each other, but if such a request was made, which I think highly likely, well, we see that Prime Minister Netanyahu and his officials have been paying no attention. Yesterday, they conducted more strikes against Iranian energy facilities. They also attacked, there was also a strike in the vicinity of the Bushehr reactor in Iran. There's reports, which I'm unable to confirm, by the way, they have appeared in the Israeli media, but I can't myself obviously confirm that Israel also attacked Iran's famous research reactor, which supposedly has a central role in Iran's nuclear program. This reactor, by the way, just to say, was supplied to Iran by the United States as long ago as the 1960s, just saying. And, well, the official who recently resigned from the US government in protest at what was happening in the Middle East, Joe Kent, the former director of counterterrorism, he has claimed that whenever there are moves by the United States and Iran to either come to some agreement with each other or to move towards negotiations, the Israelis act as spoilers. It is right. Well, it seems to me that if Vance has indeed been appointed to try to negotiate some kind of understanding between the United States and Iran to end the war, well, you could plausibly argue, based on what Joe Kent says, that these attacks by Israel on these nuclear facilities and energy facilities in Iran are, again, spoilers intended somehow to maintain, to prolong, to keep the war going. To what end exactly, I am unable to say, We see Friedrich Merz complaining about the absence of strategy, the absence of any clear plan. We see that members of Congress apparently felt the same way when they were briefed by the White House on Thursday. If the Israeli plan is to keep pounding Iran indefinitely, I don't see how that can work. It didn't destroy Hamas in Gaza. It's not going to, by itself, bring about the collapse of Iran's government and of the IRGC in a country twice the size of Ukraine with a population of 93 million people. But anyway, I get the sense that it does seem to me that whenever talk of negotiations or of compromise appears, the reaction from Prime Minister Netanyahu and his officials, including his military officials, is to carry out some act of escalation, and maybe that is what we have just seen. The Iranian Foreign Minister, Abbas Araghchi, has said that Iran will retaliate to these attacks on its reactor and energy system. We saw that last week Iran attacked Israel's own reactor at Dimona. Well, it seems to me that we must now expect more attacks of that kind. And of course, the Houthis themselves might be soon conducting attacks, strikes of their own against these Israeli facilities. And from what I can see, they're geographically much closer to these facilities than the Iranians are. That might mean that there are fewer reaction times. The reaction times are less. Who knows what might come? To finish this roundup of the situation in the Middle East, let me also quickly make a further point about the Houthis. So far, one of the factors that has, at least to a small extent, mitigated against the crisis in the Persian Gulf and kept energy prices from rising even further and even faster has been Saudi Arabia's ability to export oil through the Red Sea, oil which Saudi Arabia is transferring through its pipelines which cross the Arabian Peninsula, with oil unloaded from Saudi Arabia's Red Sea ports. Iran appears to have already conducted some kind of attack against one of Saudi Arabia's ports, though the Iranians deny this and claim that this is a false flag. I don't know. I think it's more likely that it was indeed Iran that did this. Well, Iran is a significant distance away from this pipeline and those ports. I'm not saying that these facilities are not within range of Iran's missiles. They obviously are, but geography, distance must be a factor in effectiveness of strikes against these kind of targets. The Houthis are much closer, and they have demonstrated abilities to close exits to the Red Sea. So, well, perhaps that is coming. I get the sense, as do more and more people, that the president's ability to string along global financial and energy markets, to make them believe that the war is about to end, that the Straits of Hormuz is about to be reopened. The talks between the United States and Iran are actually underway, that soon all will go back to normal and that all will be well. I'm starting to get the sense that credibility, the president's credibility, and that of his officials is beginning to weaken. I think Secretary Rubio's admission to the US allies in a closed meeting that the war is going to continue for several more weeks beyond the time point when the president himself said it would end, I think that is going to reduce credibility still more. Oil prices at close on Friday were well above $110 a barrel. If I'm right, and the credibility is now being lost, then we could start to see big price surges over the course of this coming week. In fact, I would have thought it highly likely, just saying. And let me repeat again the point that I made in another video that I did recently, which is that if in a time of shortage, you manage through whatever means to keep prices of the item which is in short supply artificially low, that simply incentivizes people to go on buying and stockpiling. And going forward, that is inevitably going to make the shortage even bigger and the eventual price hikes even greater. So anyway, that's where we are. That is where we are in this conflict up to this time. Now, I want to return to the topic of Russia and to what the Russians are doing, because it is one of the most interesting developments that we can see at the present time. There is, I've noticed, a major narrative going around that there is a major crisis of confidence in President Putin's leadership in Russia. That there's a mood of war weariness taking hold in Russia. And that President Putin is indeed coming under sustained criticism, and that his political position is in some way under threat. Now, this itself is a remarkable set of views for people to hold at a moment in time when you could argue that, in fact, validly argue that Russia's overall geopolitical position is stronger than it has been at any time since the mid-1970s. Just saying. Russia is the world's biggest energy, raw materials, food, fertilizer producer. It has abundant quantities of all of these things. I saw a report from the Russian Energy Ministry which gave confirmation, if any were needed, that within Russia itself, supplies of domestic fuels, oil, petrol, diesel, all of those things were in fully sufficient supply. There's not going to be any shortage of food in Russia. There's no reason to expect massive and uncontrolled hikes in energy costs in Russia. The Russians, however, are in pole position to export these items at higher prices to all sorts of countries around the world. They have sold, apparently, I believe it's something like 60 million barrels of oil, or is it tons of oil? I'm not sure which it is, to India over the last few weeks, now that India has really no option any longer but to ramp up purchases of Russian oil and Reliant, the one big Indian refiner, that did appear for a time to have stopped buying Russian oil. Anyway, they've now resumed oil purchases from Russia on a major scale. India is now apparently in negotiations with Russia to buy LNG from Russia, given shortages of LNG, the fact that it can no longer be supplied from the Persian Gulf, which is where India used to source it. Other countries may also have to turn to Russia for other things, helium, for example, and other types of minerals and specialized gases needed in the semiconductor industry are also now in short supply because of the block of exports from the Persian Gulf. And, well, there's rumors that Taiwanese companies are now debating with themselves whether the moment has come for them to place orders with the Russians too. And of course, the Russians continue to have their major relationship with China. And if, by the way, on the subject of Taiwan, I expect the Russians to coordinate any moves there with Beijing. But anyway, so the Russians are in pole position, economically stronger relative to the rest of the world than they have been for a very long time, as long as I can remember. They are the ally and provider of assistance to Iran, which not only is keeping Iran in the fight, but as we see, it is enabling Iran to wreak havoc on America's strategic position in the Middle East and to put pressure, economic pressure, on the United States to an extent that I have not seen. And of course, the Russians have also successfully put themselves in pole position, so that if there is ever a diplomatic effort to try to bring the conflict in the Middle East to an end, then they are the people who will be most likely to broker any talks. I've discussed this in various programs. They're the people who are busy talking to everybody, to the Iranians, to the Israelis, to the Americans. There is, by the way, and just for the record, a delegation from the Russian parliament in Washington. The Duma has actually, for the first time in many years, been given permission to send a parliamentary delegation to Washington, where they are meeting with members of Congress. There's even been an exchange of gifts, by the way, trivial items like socks, that kind of thing. But anyway, they're having meetings. The head of the Russian delegation, a man called Mikhail Degtyarev, by the way, and for the record, is on Ukraine-related matters, a very well-known hardliner, just to say. Their main interlocutor, for what it's for the record, in the United States, has been Representative Luna, just to also say. But anyway, the Russians are in a position to talk to Congress. They are able, in other words, to bypass the administration itself. They're talking with people in the United States. And yesterday, Vladimir Putin had a meeting of the Russian Security Council in which the Russians also discussed relations with Europe. And it was an interesting discussion. I say interesting, well, of course, we're not told anything about what exactly happened over the course of this discussion. Like all Russian Security Council meetings, the most important part of the discussion was kept secret. But from Putin's introductory words, it seems to me as if the Russians are now receiving increasingly urgent requests for assistance made in private from various European countries as energy costs spike, as raw materials, not just oil and gas, but pretty much everything else as well, are increasingly in short supply. And it looks to me as if the Security Council was convened by Putin in order to discuss how to respond to these requests for assistance from the Europeans, from at least some of the European states. As Putin pointed out, relations between Russia and the Europeans are in a terrible state. He was careful to say that it was the Europeans who brought them to that state. Now the Europeans are coming forward seeking help. The Russians are deciding how to respond. There will, of course, be a hefty price for the Europeans to pay. So all of this is going on. Things for the Russians are turning out well. I discussed yesterday how on the battlefront the Ukrainian defensive positions in Donbass are, in the words of the writer who goes by the name Events in Ukraine, that the Ukrainian positions there are disintegrating. And he based what he said on Ukrainian reports. So why should there be instability, war weariness, or anything like that in Russia at this time, at precisely the moment when the Russians are in the strongest position of advantage that I can remember them being in for decades? Well, I'm going to say it straight away. I think a lot of this is, frankly, a case of media spin. Just to give a sense of media spin, of the kind of media spin that's going on, there's an article in Bloomberg which says Russians' trust in Putin hits wartime low as fatigue grows. And so I went to see what the actual figures are, and indeed there's been an opinion poll, and it shows that Putin's popularity has slipped from a stratospheric 76.7% to an equally stratospheric 75%. And approval of Putin's job performance has fallen from a stratospheric 72% to a stratospheric 70.1%. To say that that kind of fall is insignificant, that it is politically irrelevant, would be, I think, an understatement. It is well within the margin of error in any opinion poll. The idea that polling data of this kind suggests any loss of support for Putin amongst the wider Russian population is, to say it straightforwardly, it is preposterous. And, well, yes, there are the usual criticisms. There's always criticisms in Russia. And this is something people find very difficult to understand. But Putin is sometimes criticized on Russian television because he's not taking a hard enough line. He's often criticized on social media in Russia, and there's particular reasons for that criticism at the moment. Many people in Russia are very unhappy about the actions that the Russian authorities are taking against Telegram and the ever-widening restrictions on social media, which we're starting to see in Russia. So it's not surprising that some people in Russia who use social media are ventilating their criticisms there. And as I've discussed many times, if you're talking about the Russian media, social media, pro-war community, well, frankly, their attitude has always been, going all the way back, not just to 2014, but to long before, that Putin is soft, that Putin is weak, that he is not really running Russia effectively. When Dmitry Medvedev, who they now mostly praise, was president of Russia, they were saying the same thing about him. I remember pointing out at that time that the narrative about Medvedev, that he was some sort of Atlantic integrationist in the pocket of the Americans, was absurd. I made this point throughout Medvedev's presidency and throughout the time when he was Russia's prime minister. And, well, I got quite a lot of pushback about it. Now, these same people who are criticising Putin for allegedly being soft are now coming forward and saying that Medvedev, who they used to damn as a Atlantic integrationist, he's the hard man who should take over and take charge of things. And if he did, things this time would be different. Well, a lot of that, as I said, there is always that criticism, that vein of criticism there. This is no longer the Soviet Union, where criticism of the leadership was impossible. Anybody who knows Russia knows that it goes on all the time. But the very opinion polls that Bloomberg is publishing, which it says show war weariness and disillusion with Putin, I would suggest actually tell the opposite story, that his position politically is not just stable, but frankly beyond challenge. Now, it is true, what is correct is that there have been, over the last few weeks, some causes of disaffection in Russia, general reasons for discontent. Firstly, in January, the Russian government increased taxes. It increased value-added tax by 2%. That is going to be an unpopular move in any country. There's no reason to think here that Russia is any different. But the single biggest underlying cause for discontent in Russia is not the conduct of the war. It is the extremely high, very tight monetary policy that the central bank has imposed, which slowed growth throughout 2025, and which in January finally led to a contraction, an economic contraction. And, well, I discussed this all at very great length with Alex Christoforou, my friend and colleague, in a program that we have just done on the Duran. I pointed out that given the rapid fall in inflation from its 2024 peak, despite the baby steps the central bank has been taking in reducing interest rates, in reality, real interest rates in Russia today are 10%, which is about the same as they were when nominal interest rates peaked in the autumn of 2024. And these very high interest rates are having an effect in slowing the economy. Inevitably, they are. And well, what caused January's contraction? And of course, this is now causing criticism. Most of the criticism is focused on the chairman of the central bank, Elvira Nabiullina, but it is creating controversy and argument. The economics ministry this morning made fairly clear that they again think that interest rate policy is too tight. Nabiullina, for her part, has fought her corner, but following a debate that Putin had with his economic advisers, my own guess is that we're going to start to see interest rates fall faster over the next few months because the Russian government, Putin himself, Nabiullina herself, have all said that they do not want to see a recession. So, anyway, that is, in my opinion, the entire explanation, the whole reason for why there's been an upward spike in some criticism from some sources over the last few weeks. In its totality, overall, Russia's position now has become stronger. The strategic partnership, let's call it that, with Iran is paying big strategic dividends. It's giving Russia leverage over the United States. And based on what happened at the Security Council meeting over the Europeans, potentially as well, it is positioning Russia to be a potential mediator if the conflict in the Middle East, is going to be ended at some point. And in the meantime, in terms of the conflict itself in Ukraine, the focus of so much attention, it is providing Russia with further advantages. There are reports over the last 24 hours that with energy supplies dwindling, the Ukrainian military is now beginning to run out of diesel oil to keep its army running. The army, of course, needs diesel oil for its trucks and its armored vehicles. Not that it has many of those left. And, well, there's also been reports that the Americans are in effect ending weapons supplies to Ukraine as these increasingly become diverted to the Middle East, that Ukraine has basically lost its air defense missile coverage. On that point, the Russians in Dniepropetrovsk region appear to have attacked and destroyed another Ukrainian Patriot missile battery, two launchers, and a radar system. There are the usual claims that these were decoys. I've seen the film footage. I have to say, if they were decoys, to me, they look like very, very efficient decoys indeed. Given that the missile system was destroyed by drones, it hardly seems worthwhile anymore. For the record, I believe it was the actual destruction of a real Patriot missile system, one of several that the Russians have successfully destroyed over the course of this war. And to repeat again, the big Russian offensive is coming probably in April, when the ground becomes hardened and the spring reorganization that always happens for the Russian military is completed. But for the further record also, in terms of the number of positions and settlements and villages and whatever it is that the Russians are capturing or saying they have captured in Ukraine, I don't notice any difference from what I have seen in previous winter periods. Every so often, it is a recurring cycle in this war that after a period of rapid Russian advance, things slow down as the Russians reach the limits of their logistics and have to re-equip and reorganize their advanced forces, and as they reach or approach fortified positions that the Ukrainians have established. And as always happens, whenever that happens, the narrative appears in the West that the Russians have run out of steam. I remember the spring of last year and the early summer was a period when exactly that happened. And then the Russians start moving again. And of course, that narrative, the stalemate narrative, the exhaustion narrative, briefly gets abandoned until at some point, eventually, it is revived again. You have to have been following this war as closely as I have done to see this. But as I said, this cycle is constantly there. And we're just going through another phase of it at the moment. Now, there is something else, and it was covered in a huge article in Reuters, which I admit I missed, but it was republished on Johnson's List, where it was seen by Jeff Roberts, the historian, who circulated it to various people, including myself, and I want to acknowledge that fact. And it was a very, very interesting article. It discussed the massive reconstruction that has been underway, not just in Crimea, but in Donbass, right across the territory that has now fallen under Russian control. And as Reuters points out, this is a multi-hundred billion dollar operation. It involves a complete reorganization, modernization, and reconstruction of the entire industrial base in this region. And by the way, the infrastructure base as well, housing, utilities, and all of those sort of things. It means the deeper economic reconstruction and integration of this whole region, Donbass, Zaporozhye, Kherson, into Russia. And, well, it also makes a further very valid, very important, very interesting point, one which Ukrainian officials who are consulted by Reuters over the course of this article are also making, which is that the Russians have massively expanded and improved the road and railway network in Zaporozhye, Kherson region, and across Donbass. Now, this is very important, and it will have an effect on military operations, like Vladimir Skibitsky, the deputy head of Ukrainian military intelligence, who, by the way, was one of Ukraine's negotiators with the Russians in Abu Dhabi and Geneva, points out. Over the course of this conflict, since the start of the special military operation in February 2022, the railway and road system has worked to Ukraine's advantage. They have had the benefit of interior lines. I remember at an earlier point in the war, the point was made that whereas because of Ukraine's control of the railway system, the way in which the railway system and the road system functioned, it was easy for the Ukrainians to transfer troops from, say, northern Donbass to Zaporozhye, that this could be done over the course of a single day. For the Russians, for whom the railway system was more complex, they would have to use more circuitous routes to move troops and supplies from one part of the conflict line to another. And what would take the Ukrainians roughly a day to do, the Russians might have to do in a week. Well, the complete reorganization of the railway system and its modernization and reconstruction, and of the road system also, means that this advantage that the Ukrainians have had in the war is now starting to disappear. In fact, because the railway system, the Russian part of the railway system, is more modern and better operated, the increasing density of the railway system under Russian control and its modernization means that it will soon be the Russians who have this logistical and maneuver advantage. And again, it's fascinating to see the methodical and painstaking way in which the Russians are doing all of this, the way they're widening roads, the way they're resurfacing roads. This has been going on behind the lines throughout the entire conflict territory. One of the reasons, one of the probable reasons why these huge armies of hundreds and thousands of men that the Russians have assembled have not so far been deployed to the battlefield is because probably the general staff has been concerned about the difficult logistics of keeping that number of men and machines supplied and operating, given the difficulties in the road and railway infrastructure. Well, this period, as I said, is ending. And based on the Reuters report, we might indeed start to see the effect of it this year. The Reuters report said something else as well. The Russians have been particularly busy building roads and railways through Zaporozhye and Kherson regions to develop the land bridge between Russia and Crimea. Whatever relevance or importance the Kerch Bridge once had for supplies has basically ended. Ukraine has attempted to interfere with this massive construction program. And in fact, I've seen pictures of Ukrainian drone strikes on railway sites and bridges and railway lines and railway stations. And I even remember one film of drone strikes on a moving Russian train. But Reuters admits that the damage done by these Ukrainian operations has been minimal. Nothing has prevented the Russians from moving forward and completing this task. And it seems that they are indeed now very close to completing it. Now, none of this, of course, gets much attention, even though, as I remember reading once, logistics are for professionals, what big arrow movements are for amateurs, just saying. But all of this, which is very like what you would expect in a war, planned and operated by an organization like the Russian General Staff will have its effect in due course, I suspect, as soon as this summer. Reuters, as is very well known, has numerous contacts with the British government and its various agencies, and I don't personally think that it is a coincidence that this article about this gigantic construction and logistics operation has come out at this time. So there it is. To summarise, and to take a cue from the article that Alex and I did on the Duran, I think Putin did overinvest in Trump last year. I think he did perhaps spend too much time, he did spend too much time in negotiations with Trump and Witkoff. I think he is embarrassed by it. I think he's angry with himself for doing it. I think he has been criticised within the Kremlin for it. But I don't think this has any bigger or greater political significance. I certainly see no sign of any political crisis in Moscow or anything like that. Putin said to the Russian industrialists 2 days ago, as I discussed in my program yesterday, that the war will continue until all of Donbass and the other territories are liberated. And from what I have heard, those words were well received by his audience. The Russians are working systematically towards their offensive. The Ukrainians are in the weaker position. Russia overall is in a very strong geopolitical position at this present time. And that's the big story about Russia today at this particular moment. All of the rest, war fatigue, crisis in the Kremlin, criticism, Medvedev against Putin, all of that is just media chatter which we should look through. Anyway, there we go. Let's see how things do turn out. Let's see what Vice President Trump, his Vice President Vance, if Trump and Netanyahu allow him what they can achieve. My own sense is that the conflict with Iran has a long way to go. I don't think it's going to be over in 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 2 months or 3 months. And I think the energy shock is going to be enormous and it's getting worse. And I think we're going to see major problems in the global economy accelerate and intensify in the next few weeks. And I see no sign of Iran, its resolve weakening, and the fact that they're getting this assistance from their allies, from the Russians, and no doubt from the Chinese too, I think that is giving them further confidence. I think that eventually there will be negotiations. But notice how carefully Medvedev talked about the 10-year period it took the United States to extricate itself from Vietnam. I don't think it's chance that Medvedev said that. Of course, it mirrors something that I myself said just a few days ago. I think that we are going to have a very complex and difficult negotiation process indeed. But in the meantime, the situation in Russia remains stable. The slowdown in the economy that we have seen will reverse once interest rates finally fall, which they will do this year. And in the meantime, the Russians are in pole position everywhere else, including on the battlefields in Ukraine. This is where I finish today's programme. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.